The second case for oral argument this morning is Paul A. Wojewski, I understand, as it's pronounced. Is that correct? Yes. Well, I got close. All right. Appellant versus Rapid City Regional Hospital, Appalese. Mr. Reynolds, an attorney from Rapid City, is for the appellant. And Mr., is that Wilczek?
Wilczek.
Well, another close one. Okay, Mr. Wilczek from Minneapolis. We'll be presenting, I understand, for the Appalese. Mr. Truri, you'll just be at council table, correct?
Correct.
All right. Very well. Then, Mr. Reynolds, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. This isn't the first time, I don't believe, that a hospital has attempted to expand limited peer review protections beyond what the law has allowed in the past. I doubt that it will be the last. In this case, Rep City Regional Hospital has endeavored to expand the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act, trying to turn it from a shield of limited and qualified immunity to essentially a force field that is capable of insulating any acts of a hospital relating to a physician. The facts are set out in the brief, but I think for the purposes of the discussion of today's appeal, what's really important is to discuss the August 19th, 2003 meeting. This was the meeting that occurred in an impromptu and informal fashion on the morning of August 19th, with four different physicians for the purposes of determining whether a surgery should take place later that day.
Excuse me just a minute. Shirley, you want to start the clock? You got some free time off.
Thank you. This was on the heels of Dr. Wojewski, who was known to be a person who suffered from bipolar disorder, having realized in June that he was starting to feel, as he put it, to the hospital manicky, took a leave of absence, came back too early in hindsight in August of 2003, On August 12th, I believe, was the date he started, and immediately he started displaying erratic behavior to members of the hospital staff and others. These erratic behaviors were reported immediately to hospital administration. Nothing was done, despite, as one person put it, begging the hospital to do something. And on August 19th, in the morning, they did have this impromptu meeting that Dr. Hart called after some midnight phone calls from a physician who said, Dr. Wojewski's out of his head, he's just charging patients, he's telling patients I did a lousy job. So they pulled together this impromptu meeting. At this impromptu meeting, they sat around and looked at each other and said, should we have this surgery? Should Dr. Wojewski perform it or not? And they scratched their heads and said, I think he's fine. They didn't invoke the impaired physician policy of the hospital. They didn't seek an emergency psychiatric consult, and none of these physicians were psychiatrists. They didn't even bother to talk to Dr. Wojewski that morning to see if he was in his right mind or not. Instead, he was allowed to go into the surgery suite. There was an erratic behavior in the surgery suite, and it was a very bad deal. And what ultimately occurred is he was kicked out of the surgery suite and kicked out of the hospital for good.
But in fairness, wasn't the ad hoc group meeting to decide whether he should really have privileges to do surgery that day?
That is what the hospital would have you believe, and that's what they said in their briefs. That is absolutely not what they could possibly undertake. They had no authority to suspend privileges. They had no authority under which to affect clinical privileges. All they had the authority to do that day as a random group of four physicians was decide whether that surgery should be postponed and then invoke peer review processes from the hospital to determine whether he should be suspended. And in fact, what happened ultimately, Your Honor, is the next day, after they did what they were supposed to do, too late, informed the chief of staff that Dr. Wojewski was having problems, a letter was sent to Dr. Wojewski invoking Section 8.2 of the bylaws, putting him on precautionary suspension, and the peer review ball started rolling at that point. They should have done is immediately upon recognizing that there was a problem, invoke that peer review process. So,
aren't they allowed to do, I mean, I can see myself in a law firm or any kind of a professional practice, talking to my partners or employees, did you see something? You know, should we report this to chief of staff? I mean, it seems to me that's the normal thing and the reasonable thing anybody would do if they're starting to suspect something.
I think it was normal and reasonable for them to have that meeting, but I don't think it was normal and reasonable for them to conclude, we have the authority and power to make this decision. Once they recognized there was a problem, under the impaired physician policy, they had to go to the chief of staff and say, there is a problem. You need to invoke our policies and procedures. So, yes, it starts by having an informal meeting of partners of a law firm saying there's something wrong with our partner Smith. But it doesn't end there with the hospital because they have a policy and procedure to follow. And more to the point is this issue.
But you're not alleging any conspiracy against the doctor that they only took half the step they should have. They acted on their own rather than going to the authority that really had the clout to do that.
Right. They acted in respectfully in incompetent fashion. I'm not suggesting there was a conspiracy.
Wasn't there also some immediacy that morning? Because the surgery was scheduled for that morning.
Absolutely.
I mean, was there time to invoke the formal process?
There was certainly time, and this should have happened days before, frankly. But there was time that morning, certainly, to call the chief of staff and say, Dr. Frost, there's an issue with Dr. Boryeski. Here's what's happened over the past 5 days. Could you please institute the impaired physician guidelines, take your authority as chief of staff, and issue a precautionary suspension? That never happened. The first Tim Frost heard of Dr. Voyevsky's situation was after the surgical incident. It's the first time anybody informed him. But what I was saying more to the point, though, is this issue of the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act.
You're claiming, though, that they did something. You're claiming that they should have contacted the chief of staff. So you're claiming that they did something wrong. Isn't that what the immunity is about, to cover whether they do something right or do something wrong? As long as they're part of the activity that leads to the peer review.
And that last clause is the key clause. Is this peer review? Was this a peer review process? We submit that it absolutely was not.
But I said that as long as this activity is what leads to the peer review. I mean, that's what they're doing. They're reviewing one of their peers, aren't they, in just common sense language.
I believe they were reviewing whether the surgery should occur. In some respect, they were saying, is Dr. Boryeski in his right mind today to perform surgery?
Well, yes. There's no reason the surgery would not continue unless there's some impairment on his part.
Right. When they knew there was a suspicion, they should have gone to the chief of staff, but barring not following their own rules, at a minimum, their duty was to say, this patient is not in jeopardy. We can transfer this patient or find another physician to do this surgery, which everybody has testified was the case. Let's hold the presses and find out what's wrong with Dr. Boryeski and get him help.
So does it depend in your mind then on whether or not they make the right decision or the wrong decision?
Well, they certainly, not necessarily, but I think that's, once we get through the immunity realm, and that's the key issue here, that would be a decision for the trier of fact. Was that improper for them to have not stopped him from performing surgery and not reported it to the chief of staff?
What does it matter if they have immunity?
It wouldn't matter if they do, but they do not, because this was not a peer review meeting. It was not called by a peer review committee. The hospital has peer review policy is this thick. Nowhere does it say that Dr. Hart, the interim CEO, can pull together three or four doctors, scratch their heads, and talk about this and make a decision about whether a surgery should be performed. That's why they have the impaired physician policy. That's why they have the bylaws. You know, the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act is very clear about what a peer review body is. They are conducting a peer review activity. A peer review activity, as defined, and the hospital points this out, is something in which a determination is made whether a doctor may have clinical privileges. This little group of four physicians didn't have that authority. Whether there were, what the conditions were of such privileges, they had no authority to do that. Or whether there should be changes or modifications to privileges, they had no authority to do that. They were deciding whether there should be a surgery performed that day.
Well, wait a second, though. The letter of agreement that he was operating under was clearly had to do with his privileges and would be part of peer review, right?
Absolutely.
And I see, in one of the paragraphs, the doctor agrees that his status will be disclosed and discussed among treating physicians and among hospital employees having a need to know. So isn't this effectively suggesting that this is part of the peer review process?
What that is suggesting is that Dr. Boryeski has a duty to inform anyone that has a need to know that he has a condition. And the testimony at the fair hearing panel in the hospital was he did that. He would say to people, I need you to know you're a new member to my staff. I need you to know I have this disease. And here's some of the manifestations of it. When I'm out of my mind, I can't stop it. I can't control it. I need your help. You need to go to the hospital. You need to tell them. That's what that provision relates to. This is decidedly not a peer review activity because they had no authority to affect privileges. This was nothing more than an amalgam of individuals.
I thought you just told me that they had a right to get together and talk about the situation, but that they did not go to the authority that had the...
That would be true. The peer review process had not been invoked by the virtue of them getting together and meeting. That's not a peer review process any more than that they brought, you know, somebody from the cafeteria in and said, have you seen Dr. Boyeski's behavior? That's not peer review. They were not charged by a peer review body to do anything. No recommendations went to peer review. And the proof may be in the pudding, because when it finally did go to peer review, all they cared about with peer review was what happened in that surgery suite. They put on witness after witness after witness to talk about this horrible situation that occurred in the surgery suite. It had nothing to do with the precursors to that. They didn't care about that. They said that Dr. Boyeski, just out of the blue, was their quote, showed erratic behavior in the surgery suite despite what happened the previous 5 days.
Well, there were conflicting reports. Wasn't there a report from his own psychiatrist saying that he was okay, that it wasn't a problem?
Yeah. Dr. Manlove missed it. There's no doubt about that in his random meeting. But they had 4, 5, 6 people going to the hospital administration. He wanted to be called the general. He was discharging patients indiscriminately. The man was sick. And Daryl Sieg, for example, one of the paraprofessionals there, went to Dr. Hart with a book on bipolar disorder and said, please, this guy is manic right now. Do something. And that's the type of reports the hospital was getting prior to August 19th of 2003.
Were any one of the people who were involved in this, what you call this informal ad hoc group, were any one of them responsible for overseeing his behavior?
Dr. Auri, who was another cardiothoracic surgeon, was a gentleman who, under that letter agreement, agreed, I believe, I don't know what the phrase exactly was, but to provide proctorship services. He was consulted with regard to whether or not a surgery should happen and when it should happen. That was one of his functions under the letter of agreement.
He was one of the people who was discussing the concerns and whether the surgery should go ahead or not.
Right, he was.
Could just he alone satisfy the peer review requirement?
I don't believe so, because of the fact that there was a policy in place. If there hadn't been a policy in place, perhaps, but it was his obligation to talk to Dr. Boyeski, find out what his surgeries were planned, get a little feel for his mental state, and if there were issues, bring him the attention of the administration so that peer review could be invoked. Dr. Auri, admittedly, after the fact, says it was ridiculous for me to be making some of these decisions because I'm not a psychiatrist, but it was his duty to go forth, bring that to the attention of people, and then the peer review process should be invoked. So we can't have the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act interpreted so broadly as to envelop any grouping of physicians that just have a random conversation about a physician. Otherwise, why would we even have peer review processes in place? Why would we have the processes that the hospital has that invokes the medical executive committee and invokes the appellate process and invokes the board and allows them to actually appoint ad hoc committees? The Matthews case is a perfect example. One of the things the hospital tries to tell you is this was an ad hoc committee, as if those words provide some authority. An ad hoc committee, we all know, is a committee that is empowered by another board, perhaps a subcommittee, to go forth and to undertake some certain acts. And the Matthews case, cited in the briefs, is a perfect example of that. In that case, the peer review board charged a committee to go out and do certain things and said, please come back with recommendations and findings. We want you to do this. The question there was that committee protected by healthcare quality improvement immunity? And the answer was a clear yes, because they were working under the auspices and by the direction of a peer review committee.
Does the peer review policy name the people that it can work under the peer review policy, or limit or include those who can or cannot work?
I don't think it does by specificity. It talks about committees and processes and procedures that must be followed. It doesn't talk about... It'll talk in broad terms of chief of staff has the authority, for example, to invoke precautionary suspensions unilaterally, which is what happened here. It'll talk about specific positions, but it doesn't talk about, to the best of my knowledge, the ability for random groups to come together, call themselves peer review, and protect themselves from liability as a result.
Let me go back to the letter agreement one more time, because you responded to my question indicating that he had a duty to educate and tell people about his condition, what might relapse. But the paragraph I'm looking at is another paragraph wherein he says that he agrees my status will be disclosed and discussed among hospital employees. Doesn't that, with this letter agreement, which is a part of peer review, where he agrees that it's going to be disclosed and discussed among employees, doesn't that make this group that morning essentially a part of this letter agreement?
I still respectfully don't think so. I still contend that disclose and discuss means so everybody knows about his condition. But beyond that, I mean, certainly he opened up his life to scrutiny when he entered in that letter agreement. He said, I'm an open book. You can talk to my doctors. You can send me on medical examinations. You can take blood and urine tests. I'm an open book. I want everybody to know about this. But that doesn't bypass the fact that although this has to be fully disclosed, there are policies and procedures that must be followed when a problem occurs. And when they realize that he is manic, they still have to invoke the policies and procedures of the hospital as set forth in the bylaws and in the impaired physician policy. I don't think that changes anything about that. It just says, my life's an open book. I want to be here. I got a problem. I can't help it, and I need your help in order for me to be able to perform my surgery as I've been doing for 20 years or 15 years.
Had they followed the procedures, would these doctors that you're complaining of, would they have been protected under the Act?
Had they followed the procedures, they would not have been protected under the Act, but it would have taken them out of any exposure because then it became an issue where peer review had to make their decisions. Once they did that step, immunity would have been invoked, but they didn't do that step. They stopped at the threshold of it. So there would have been no culpability if they had done the right thing and taken it to peer review. If peer review messed up, we wouldn't be here today.
So you're saying that they should not have met together that morning. Instead, they should have individually gone to the chief of staff. Is that what?
Not precisely. I don't fault them for meeting. I don't think it was something I would have necessarily done. They knew full well this guy was sick. I think 4 days before they should have gone to the chief of staff, but they didn't. And that morning, when they still hadn't gone to the chief of staff, if they had that meeting, the first thing they should have done is say, hold off on the surgery right now. Contact Tim Frost, the chief of staff, and let's get this ball rolling. Let's find out what's wrong with Dr. Boyeski and get him some help. That's what they should have done. Do I fault them for meeting? They shouldn't have done it that way. They knew.
Wouldn't have they been liable for that, too, under your theory?
No, not at all, because as I said to Justice Meyer-Henry, at that point in time, they would have absolved themselves from responsibility. They took it upon themselves to make these decisions. It wasn't their decision to make. They were to take that to peer review. And once they did that, wash their hands of it. They're done with their responsibility. They've done their duty.
I think what Justice Savers is saying is that they'd be liable, or maybe make the hospital liable, for failing to get their heads together and say, you know, should we let this guy do surgery this morning?
Perhaps. They failed 3-4 days before but not doing anything, knowing that he was sick, in my view. I'm really running out of time. I want to talk about the common law claims, but there's two other things on Healthcare Quality Improvement Act I have to mention, and that is, even if there was immunity here, which there isn't, it's not peer review, but even if it was, the law says that there has to be, quote, reasonable efforts to obtain facts under this immunity, and there has to be a reasonable belief that the actions were in furtherance of quality health care. I would submit there's certainly a genuine issue of material fact of whether that occurred here. They didn't even talk to Dr. Boyeski that morning to see if he was in his right head before they made this decision to allow him to perform surgery. They didn't talk to a psychiatric consult. They didn't have him examined. I'd submit that there's certainly an issue of whether that was in a reasonable effort to obtain facts. They didn't talk to any of the other people who had been complaining about Dr. Boyeski's behavior that morning. And certainly in the same vein, was that a reasonable step taken to reasonably further quality health care? I think discretion is a greater part of valor here. And certainly if you have an issue about a physician being in his right head to perform delicate open-heart surgery, you probably postpone the surgery and find out.
Well, following up on a question of Justice Savers, I mean, if you didn't do anything wrong, you don't need immunity because you're not negligent or liable to begin with. What good is the immunity if they lose it for any improper conduct?
Because this wasn't peer review. And the second they started the peer review process, they would have been immune. Whatever they did, if they had talked to Tim Frost and Tim Frost said, let him do the surgery, I don't think I'd be here today. But they didn't. They have to have been involved in the peer review activity or peer review process, and they weren't. If they had done that, none of this would have happened. And I wouldn't have a cause of action clearly if that had happened. A couple things on the common law claims, because Judge Kern also, we believe, granted summary judgment on the common law claims. Remember, this case, there had been no discovery. This was the first action out of the gate in this case. There was a fair hearing process, but that was a different animal than a piece of litigation. I'll talk about breach of fiduciary duty very briefly, because I think that's the most palpable error, respectfully, that Judge Kern committed in granting summary judgment. Rapid City Regional Hospital is right. In a normal doctor hospital relationship. It's arm's length, and there is no fiduciary duty. They took an enhanced role here. If you look at your High Plains and Ainsworth cases, you have to look at additional circumstances. The letter of agreement is an additional circumstance. The mere fact that they knew that Dr. Voyeski was bipolar, and they said, we will take you in, and we will have you as a physician on the staff, and we will make a lot of money off of you, but we know you have this condition, and we know when you have this condition, you are completely out of your mind, and you need our help. That hits completely the definition of dependence, weakness of mental state, I think was a quote in ChemAge, if I'm not mistaken. It satisfies all three of the ChemAge prongs. Faith and confidence and trust in the hospital. He's saying there, take care of me when I'm sick. I need your help in identifying when I'm sick. When he is sick, there is absolute inequality of the parties. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's dependent upon them to do something. He's weak of mind, and he has no knowledge of what he's doing when he's sick. That is an extraordinary additional circumstance, and there was a breach of fiduciary duty here. Same with aiding and abetting fiduciary duty. Tortious interference, a game of semantics. It's unjustified interference. The word acts appear in the case, but failing to act is an act. Deciding not to go to peer review is an act. Deciding to let him perform surgery and not counseling it is an act, and so on and so off. To decide not to go to the chief of staff is an act. Intentional infliction of emotional distress. There was no extreme and outrageous behavior. I know that the Reeves versus Ryman case is horrible, and it evokes something in our gut. To have somebody allowed to perform open-heart surgery when they know he's mentally ill, I believe, is as extreme and outrageous as it becomes. They not only jeopardized him, but they jeopardized the patient as well.
Your time has expired. Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. Counsel, you have 20 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel. Mr. True and I appreciate the opportunity to present our arguments to the court and answer any questions you might have this morning. A key issue in this case, obviously, is the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act, known as HICWA. And it's important to note at the outset that Congress enacted HICWA to protect patients. That's what HICWA is all about. And it protects patients by providing safeguards that help ensure effective peer review of physicians by physicians. That's what HICWA was all about. And Judge Kern properly decided in this case to dismiss the claims of Dr. Voyeski on two independently sufficient bases. The first is that the total immunity granted under HICWA for the acts challenged by Dr. Voyeski in this action applies. And second, that the various common law claims asserted by Dr. Voyeski all fail to state a claim. Now, this case arises from the termination of Dr. Voyeski's privileges as a heart surgeon at Rapid City Regional Hospital. And it was a decision reached following a hearing before a fair hearing panel.
Well, just a second, though.
Yes.
I thought that counsel, Ms. Reynolds, was very specific that this case does not arise from the termination of his privileges. It arises solely from the conduct on August 19 before the termination occurred.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the case is all about the termination of privileges. That's where all the damages come from. But putting that to one side, the focus on the August 19 meeting, the ad hoc meeting, as Mr. Reynolds referred to it, is covered by the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act. And it's covered because it is professional review activity. The protections available under HICWA are not limited to professional review actions. The action in this case is the decision to terminate his privileges. The definition of professional review action includes professional review activities. And those professional review activities are typically a precursor to the professional review action. And professional review activities are equally immune under HICWA as the professional review action, provided that they are related to the professional review action.
I take it you disagree with counsel then that that they lacked the authority to do what they did, and they should have instead gone to the administrator.
Yes, and actually the type of immediate action that Mr. Reynolds says should have occurred after the August 19 meeting is something that's contemplated in HCWA itself. It has in provision 1112C2 a specific provision that allows immediate suspension and termination, or I'm sorry, immediate suspension or modification of privileges, and that's what's going on here. I mean, it was a peer review process. Those were the peers. So it is something that is protected.
But they didn't follow the policy, the impaired physician policy.
Well, Your Honor, the impaired physician policy is a medical staff guideline. Okay, it's a guideline. It's not a requirement. There's nothing in that policy that has any type of the mandatory contractual language or any type of the temporal immediacy provisions.
No, but that is the procedure by which peer review is initiated.
Well, I would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor. I believe all the activities that occurred that led up to the decision are all peer review activities. When the peers of Dr. Wojewski got together, including the interim CEO, the medical staff liaison, and the individual who was given the responsibility for supervising Dr. Wojewski, met on the morning of August 19 to determine whether or not he would be allowed to conduct surgery, that, Your Honor, I believe was peer review. That was professional review activity under the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act, and it is entitled to immunity under that law, because they were making that decision regarding whether or not Dr. Wojewski would be permitted, despite his indications that he was able to conduct that surgery, whether he would be permitted to go into surgery that day. That was professional review activity protected by the Act. And if it is related to the professional review action, it is clearly entitled to immunity under the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act. That is clear if you look at the definition of professional review action, which again expressly includes professional review activity. So the only issue is if whether or not that activity is immune under HCWA is whether it was related to the professional review action, which was the decision to terminate Dr. Wojewski's privileges. And in this case, it clearly was on a number of bases. First, it was obviously temporally related. It was only a couple of hours before Dr. Wojewski went into surgery. Second, it was substantive related. It's exactly the same issue that the fair hearing panel considered and reviewed and determined after the 4 days of testimony.
I don't know that the fair hearing panel focused on the incident in the surgery room and did not spend time or make findings or very many findings about all this other behavior that led up to the surgery room incident.
I believe that's incorrect, Your Honor. And I would point your attention to finding 18 in the conclusions of fact adopted by the fair hearing panel. In that conclusion, in that statement of their finding of fact, they concluded that Dr. Hart and Dr. Allen had acted responsibly and appropriately in the meeting on the morning of August 19. And they made that finding of fact because that was an issue expressly raised by Dr. Wojewski and his attorney at the hearing. They raised whether or not somehow Dr. Wojewski wasn't responsible for what happened in the August of 19 because somehow the hospital or the doctors failed in their responsibility in that meeting on August 19.
Well, that's kind of a self-serving finding, but were there other findings concerning Dr. Wojewski's behavior leading up to the incident?
Yes, there were findings that went far beyond the August 19 situation involving how these incidents of mania would occur without warning. They would occur immediately after psychiatrists had found him to be fully capable. So there was a complete review of the evidence. But what the fair hearing panel found, and this is very important to emphasize, they didn't find that they were taking away Dr. Wojewski's privileges because of what happened in the operating room on August 19. They made the decision based upon the entire record that was presented to them, including testimony from three psychiatrists, that Dr. Wojewski had a bipolar condition in which the mania arose unpredictably, in a manner that could not be effectively monitored, and in a manner, because it couldn't be effectively monitored, it would result in serious risk of injury to patients in the future. That was the key finding of the fair hearing panel. If Dr. Wojewski's condition of bipolar and the unpredictable relapses of mania, the inability to effectively monitor those and predict them, left the patients in danger if his privileges were not.
Except this ad hoc group here decided the opposite that morning.
Yes, Your Honor.
So they did. Why does the immunity start there?
Well,
their inaction, I mean, had they acted and went through the procedure and all that, obviously I think we all agree, or I hear the parties agree, that they would clearly be immune under this act. But it's the inactivity, which goes against what the review group finally determined, that they say they are not covered by. So why is their inactivity, their decision that morning, protected when they didn't proceed with the review bodies and they decided on their own, this ad hoc group, that he can go ahead and do surgery?
Your Honor, if I could just restate your question. It wasn't inactivity. There was activity. It was professional review activity. And the actions of Drs. Hart, Dr. Allen, and Dr. Ori, and Dr. Nesbitt, when they got together in the morning of August 19, was professional review activity. Now,
is there a provision in the bylaws or in their procedure or whatever that covers an informal gathering like this? How do you determine when you can call it a peer group?
Well,
a professional review body. How is that defined in the process or the procedures?
Professional review body certainly is defined in HICWA, and that's an important point to note. A professional review body includes a healthcare entity. Okay, it doesn't include a specific committee or professional review committee. It includes a healthcare entity. And in this case, Rapid City Regional Hospital clearly is a healthcare entity. Dr. Hart and Dr. Allen, the CEO, the medical staff liaison, clearly were acting on behalf of.
How do we know? You say that. How do we know they clearly were? Is there something in the procedure that indicates that that authority is delegated to anybody who decides that they are that professional review committee that morning?
Well, Dr. Hart was the chief executive officer. The chief of staff, Dr. Frost, was out of town at the time. It is within their scope of responsibilities. If something untoward happened, the CEO would be the person who would be held responsible for the inaction on behalf of the hospital. So that is, I think, attendant in the position that he held. And the individuals were engaged in professional review activity, and that's entitled to immunity, provided that it's related to the professional review action. And it is important to note that the definition of professional review action expressly includes, as part of what's covered, the decision not to proceed with any type of action to limit privileges in any regard. And the reason why I think that's significant is that underscores, I think, what is Congress's intent, that the professional review activity and the professional review action do not necessarily need to be consistent to be protected under the Act. That there can be a decision, for example, I think that's the situation that the statute contemplates, where the professional review activity indicated that there should be some type of restriction in privileges, but the professional review action concluded that there did not need to be. And HICWA wanted to ensure that professional review activity was protected, even if it was inconsistent with the professional review action. This situation is exactly the opposite of that, but I think the principle still applies. Professional review activity is entitled to the same degree of immunity as the professional review action, provided that it is related. The other point I want to make is that Judge Kern was absolutely correct in making an early decision regarding the dismissal of claims against the hospital. That is recognized by the First Circuit in Singh, the 11th Circuit in the O'Brien case, both of which are cited in our brief. HICWA contemplates the early action and the early decision regarding the application of HICWA. And one can understand the policy of that, the policy reasons behind that when you think about the purpose of HICWA, which is to provide for patient health care, provide for high quality health care. And that is if doctors who participate at any step in the process that leading up to a decision to revoke privileges are subject to some type of being drawn into protracted and expensive litigation, that will chill the process, it will chill their interest in engaging in the peer review process, and will have a negative effect on health care. So the early dismissal, the early action of Judge Kern in this action is entirely appropriate.
Now, did she make findings of any sort?
Well, she had a very brief opinion, Your Honor, but the transcript of her comments where she discussed each of the claims and the bases for her rulings were a part of the record that were transmitted to this court. And in that, she made the conclusion that dismissal was proper both under ERISA and on each of the common law causes of action looked at individually. And with that, if Your Honors don't have any further questions regarding HICWA, I will address the common law basis. But first of all, if I could, just reemphasize that if you agree that HICWA's immunity extends to the professional review activity, the August 19 meeting, the inquiry really ends there, and there is no need to look at each of these independent arguments that I'm going to talk about now. And if I could just make one more comment regarding HICWA. As I pointed out, Section 18 of the findings of fact expressly addresses whether or not Dr. Hart and Dr. Allen acted in any way unreasonably or inappropriately in the August 19 meeting. What is here, what underscores all of plaintiff's claims, appellant's claims here, is the claim that they acted inappropriately. So in effect, what Dr. Wojewski is asking this court to do, to allow what it is expressly forbidden from doing under HICWA, and that is to allow a retrying of that issue, to allow a finder of fact to engage in reweighing the evidence. That's not what HICWA permits. If it is in the furtherance of healthcare, and if the procedural requirements are met, that decision must be followed. And with regard to the individual...
One more question.
Yes, sir.
Before you go there, you rely on the Matthews case, but doesn't it appear in that case that actually that ad hoc committee was meeting under the authority of the president of the staff? Doesn't that make that case totally different than ours?
Well, it may be different on some basis factually, but under HICWA, it's not different. Because HICWA does not require that professional review activity be conducted by any specific person with any specific authority. The question is whether or not it's analyzing issues related to whether or not privileges should be changed or modified in part. And if it is related to that, if it is addressing that issue, and if its activity is related to a later professional review action, it is entitled to immunity under HICWA. There's nothing in HICWA that says that it can only be action that is authorized by any specific committee or person. Turning briefly to the common law causes of action, the first one is the breach of contract claim. I mentioned that earlier. The provision, the policy that counsel asserts should be a contract in this case does not have any of the characteristics one would expect to see in a contract. It expressly states that it is a guideline not for the hospital, guideline for medical staff. It doesn't contain any of the binding mandatory language typically found in contracts, require, must, shall. Instead, the only thing found in that provision is the word should, which is not contractual binding language. Finally, there is nothing of the temporal requirement that counsel would lead one to believe is present in that case. It doesn't say you need to immediately do it or you can't do anything until you've contacted the chief of staff. So I think it is entirely different from the type of provision that this court considered to be a binding contract in the St. John's Hospital case. The second case is the tortious interference with contract with business advantage theory. Counsel addressed that briefly. It's not a matter of semantics, the difference between a decision not to act and an act. This court has made statements entirely consistent with the restatement of torts second, which states that the defendant must commit an act to interfere with the party's relationship with third parties. There was no act in this case, absolutely none at all. Instead of asserting a claim for interference with prospective business advantage, I believe what counsel here is doing is trying to create a new cause of action, creating affirmative obligation to preserve business relationships, and that's simply not the law. Breach of fiduciary duty claim, Judge Kern found that there was no fiduciary relationship. That's absolutely the correct finding here. There is no doubt that the base relationship was one of an arm's-length business relationship between the hospital and Dr. Wojewski. Counsel claims that that was transformed into a fiduciary relationship because of two things, Dr. Wojewski's bipolar condition and this letter of conditions for his return to the staff. Appellant cites no cases indicating that the fact that someone has a bipolar condition and that they have a manic state transforms an arm's-length business relationship into a fiduciary relationship. And I believe there's good reason why there's no such decisions, because that would cause individuals to be reluctant to enter into any type of business relationship with individuals with the bipolar disorder for fear that perhaps even unknown to them, they would have slipped into a fiduciary relationship because this individual was currently undergoing a manic attack. Similarly, with regard to the letter of conditions, Your Honor, those were conditions established to protect the patients. They weren't conditions established to protect Dr. Wojewski. They do not create any type of fiduciary relationship. Indeed, it's noteworthy that the Eighth Circuit found that that letter of conditions is not even sufficient to create an employment relationship.
Your time has expired, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Reynolds, you have 10 minutes.
Briefly on the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act argument the counsel made, I think it's very important, and with 20 minutes it's hard to describe something as complicated as the parameters of the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act, but I think it's important to remember three principal definitions when you're back deliberating, if I could suggest that. One is the definition of a professional review body, as cited in the statute. The second is the definition of a professional review action, and the third is the definition of a professional review activity. A professional review body is one that is a committee of a healthcare entity which conducts a professional review activity. That didn't happen here. This was not a committee of a professional review body. I don't even like the word ad hoc because I believe ad hoc has some formality to it. I'm going to call it an impromptu meeting that was thrown together. It was not a professional review action. A professional review action under the statute is an action or recommendation of a professional review body which is taken or made in the conduct of a professional review activity. There was no action or recommendation from this impromptu group of physicians. They were there deciding one issue and one issue only. Should this surgery happen or not? And finally, probably most importantly, Mr. Wilczek continues to discuss the fact that there was professional review activity occurring at that August 19th meeting. I think that clearly not, because in his own brief, he defines professional review activity from a case that's not coming to my mind right now as, is there a determination made as to whether the doctor may have clinical privileges? That's a professional review activity. That wasn't happening at that August 19th meeting. Was there a determination of a condition of a doctor's privileges being altered or changed? No. They weren't doing that. They didn't have the power to do that. They weren't charged by a professional review body to even look at that question. Were there changes or modifications being considered to privileges? The answer is no. Again, they try to play semantics, but all they were deciding was, should the surgery happen or not? And in fact, the truth is belied in some respect by their own findings that have been brought up here. On finding 17, I just happened to notice when I was looking at finding 18, because it became an issue, the four physicians unanimously concluded that Dr. Boyeski was fit to perform the surgery. And they said in finding 15 that they discussed recent behavior and whether he should be allowed to perform the surgery later that morning. It was an issue of whether the surgery should happen. It wasn't an issue of whether he should have conditions of his privileges revoked, suspended, etc. They didn't have that power. But what would have happened is they made the right decision and sent it to the impaired physician policy provision. The chief of staff would have made the decision. But what should have happened is they should have said, no surgery today. Let's take it to peer review, figure out what's going to happen here. Let's
Isn't a decision to postpone surgery the absolute equivalent of infringing on his privileges to do surgery when he is scheduled to do surgery, when he's got to wind up with his patient? Doesn't that relate to his privileges under the hospital?
No, it would have no effect on his privileges whatsoever.
One privilege he's got is to do surgery at the time and place scheduled, and they're postponing it.
Well, we're talking about privileges with a capital P or privileges with a little p. The privileges being referred to in the peer review process is technical privileges to perform certain acts. Now,
like surgery at a given time and place.
Right, like surgery at a given time and place. But the postponement of a surgery is not affecting his underlying privileges to perform his functions at a hospital. If he was walking in with a heart attack, which is equivalent to this, or in a diabetic state, which I believe is the best analogy, that surgery would have been postponed. Would that have been an undermining of his privileges? Of course not. In fact, if anything, it's protecting him. There is an element of protecting him from himself here, because if you're sick and you're sent in to surgery, it could have adverse effect on your privileges, which is exactly what happened here. If anything, their failure to do anything undermined his privileges ultimately, in my view. Please don't get caught up in the semantics game of this being called a professional review body because they happen to be physicians talking about a situation.
Where did counsel, your opposing counsel, get the argument? He says that the Act defines the body as a healthcare entity.
That's under the definition of professional review body, 11151, subparagraph 11 of HICWA. It is in our brief, and we cite it in full, and it does say it's a healthcare entity or a committee of a healthcare entity which conducts professional review activity. In this instance, it's my argument, we're talking about a, quote, committee. That's the issue here. Is this a committee of a healthcare entity charged with the responsibility of conducting professional review activity? And they aren't. The implication of what Mr. Wilczek is suggesting is that any group of physicians can come in and call themselves peer review if they have anything to do with surgery, hospital, conduct of administration, anything that might have an effect on a potential lawsuit down the road by a physician or a patient is peer review. That is not the intent of HICWA. Let's not deceive ourselves as to what peer review protections are. You folks see this every day. Peer review protection is to protect the patient. It's to allow free and open discussion of physicians and problems physicians have in the context of the peer review process so that there is not fear of liability. That envelope exists here. It exists the moment they follow their procedures and go to the chief of staff. And had they done that, we wouldn't be here today. But they didn't. They chose a different route. They took it out of peer review, and as a result, they violated their duty to Dr. Boyeski, and they violated the policies of the hospital. And in that regard, I did not get a chance to talk much about the impaired physician policy. Again, we have a lot of issues of semantics here, acts versus failure to acts, ad hoc committees versus not. Let's look at exactly what's underlying the situation here. Hospital bylaws are considered to be contracts. Do they have the traditional elements of consideration in the hospital bylaws? Do you see a spot there that says for good and valuable consideration, $1 or something of that nature? No. Consideration in bylaws is tacit. What they're saying in hospital bylaws is, we have certain obligations, you have certain obligations. You're going to treat patients, you're going to follow these rules, and we're going to provide you with an environment in which you can do that. That's what hospital bylaws in very coarse fashion say. That's the mutuality of the contract there. This is no different. This is a sub-element and sub-requirement of the bylaws. The bylaws empowers a medical staff to to pass policies and procedures consistent with the bylaws. And that's what they did here. This policy says, if you're impaired, we have this obligation. And if you're impaired, you have these obligations. And I think what's telling, and I didn't even catch this until I was preparing for the argument today, but as I was looking through the impaired physician statement, on the very top, and I don't have the exact record citation, I apologize, but on the very top, in the description of impaired physician policy, there's a line that says approved by, and it shows medical staff personnel. And then the next line is approved by, it's the president of the hospital that has to approve that policy. The president or the vice president of the hospital has to approve that policy. That is a policy of the hospital, of Rapid City Regional Hospital, not just a policy of the medical staff. And it has the same elements of consideration as a bylaw does. With regard to Mr. Wilczek's argument that there's nothing in that contract that says it has to be immediate, I use the analogy in my brief, I can't come up with a better one. Somebody has stumbled drunk down the hallway going into surgery, and you see that. Under Mr. Wilczek's theory, you have no obligation on the impaired physician guidelines to do anything right then. You can wait until after the surgery. You can wait for 2 or 3 days. Respectfully, that's preposterous. If you see a situation in which a physician is impaired, pursuant to the impaired physician policy statement, you must take immediate action, whether it uses the word immediate or not, and whether it uses a mandatory language or not. Under that policy, it says you go to the department head or you go to the chief of staff. If you go to the department head has the requirement to immediately go to the chief of staff, and the process starts at that point. So I don't believe there's any value or validity to the statement that they don't have to act immediately.
But the doctor who sees that, and he sees another group of doctors over there who he wonders if they've seen the same thing, he can't go over and talk to them without liability and get them to engage in whether or not membership privileges or surgery that afternoon should be canceled. There's no immunity for that, right?
Right, unless he were to do what he's supposed to do, which is one of two things I would say in that setting. Immediately go over and say, hold off the surgery, I believe this physician is impaired, I'm going to contact the chief of staff. Contact the chief of staff by phone. Dr. Frost was available by phone in this instance.
So what they'd have to do is they'd have to each get their own lawyer on the phone and see whether or not their activity is engaged in immune acts or whether or not they're subjecting themselves to liability for conversing about whether or not this doctor should perform surgery that afternoon.
I believe that a physician smart enough to know that in this scenario, if there's an impaired physician and they take steps to start the peer review process, that they would be insulated from liability in that situation. But if they make a determination, you know, it's kind of like the last clear chance doctor. If they make the determination, they see someone is clearly impaired, is about to perform open heart surgery and lift the heart out of someone's chest and don't do anything about it, yes, I believe they are liable. And that's what happened here. It's precisely the same situation. They follow the rules they know exist. They obligated themselves to abide by the impaired physician policy statement. They're obligated to do that. They didn't do it. Then they are culpable.
Your time has expired. Thank you, counsel. Be in recess for 10 minutes.